Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Thursday, March 26th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Amelia Newcomb.
And I'm Timmy Broderick.
The extraordinary changes brought on by the coronavirus have sent me back to family conversations about life during World War II. My grandfather, father, and stepfather all served. My mother spoke of volunteer plane spotting and rationing. I decided to ask my stepmother, Nancy, who grew up in upstate New York and now lives in Manhattan, about how understanding the spirit then could help us now. After all, history can look tidy from a distance. The messiness is there, but it's eased by our vantage point. But when you don't know the outcome? Nancy recalls reports from a family friend, a British refugee whose husband was an officer in North Africa. His grim letters shared that he could see no end in sight. Because of our friends and FDR's chats and the nightly news, we were very conscious of it all the time, Nancy says. The uncertainty was palpable. Nancy recalls driving one day with her father and sister as the car radio delivered bad news. The young girls wanted assurance of victory that Dad couldn't provide. I remember Jill telling me that was the first time it occurred to her that the Allied forces might not triumph, Nancy says. But there was the flip side. They helped refugees. They supported donation centers. And on December 8, 1941, the United States went on a full war footing. In my lifetime, I haven't seen everyone as united as they were in World War II, Nancy says. But now, it's like what I see in New York. Everyone is in. Now to our five stories. Today, we examine the ethical quandaries of weighing the global economy against public health and who governs U.S. lockdown conditions. And we also have a new installment of Comfort Films for you. Our first story, tame the coronavirus, then tackle the economy? A difficult and sensitive debate is emerging over how to get back to open for business.
On Thursday, the U.S. Labor Department reported that 3.3 million Americans filed initial jobless claims, a record in more than 50 years of data and more than four times the previous record. It's a sign of how the stay-at-home orders that 21 states will have in place by the end of this week represent a blunt instrument, which may help keep the coronavirus from spreading, but is also pounding the economy in unprecedented ways. Some Americans are chafing already at the restrictions, not least of them President Donald Trump, who this week suggested lifting restrictions, at least partially, by Easter on April 12th to start revving up the economy. And some economists are also calling for a return to work timetable to protect the economy from long-term damage. Still, the recent focus on containing the spread of the COVID-19 disease could be key to limiting the ultimate costs both to the economy and to human lives. We have to stop the threat of this epidemic, says Sherry Gleed, a health economist and a dean at New York University. There's no point rebuilding while the bombs are still dropping. This story was reported by Lauren Belsey and Henry Gass for The Monitor.
Travel bans, quarantines, and shelter-in-place orders. It's a lot to keep track of. Here, Peter Greer walks us through the laws and regulations underpinning government actions to protect public health.
On March 16th, President Donald Trump issued coronavirus guidelines for the nation, titled 15 Days to Slow the Spread. Among other things, the guidelines advised working from home if possible and avoiding social gatherings of more than 10 people. As the 15-day mark approaches, Mr. Trump has become vocal about the possibility of lifting restrictions so as to get the economy moving again. But the president himself has no direct power to turn most of these musings into action. His 15-day recommendations were advisory. It is state governors and city mayors who have used their police powers to issue edicts. Of course, there are other coronavirus issues where Washington does have direct power. On January 31st, Mr. Trump barred entry into the United States of any foreign national who had been in mainland China in the prior 2 weeks. The White House has since issued similar edicts involving Iran, continental Europe, Ireland, and the United Kingdom. Also, Washington has the power to quarantine people to block the spread of communicable disease from other nations or between the states. But for most Americans, the shelter-in-place orders issued by state or local authorities will be far more important than such action taken by the federal government. This story was reported by Peter Greer for The Monitor.
People around the world have praised quick action on the coronavirus, even as they've worried about leaders exploiting power down the road. It's a particular concern in countries that have experienced authoritarian rule.
Earlier this month, Latin American leaders seemed to be looking the other way when it came to COVID-19. But not El Salvador. The Central American country, about the size of Massachusetts, took strong action before it had registered a single case. More recently, the nation has implemented a nationwide quarantine, and the young president threatened that citizens breaking it would be brought to containment centers. Many insist that today's tough decisions to fight the new coronavirus, led by President Nayib Bukele, will put El Salvador on the right side of history. But in a region with a history of authoritarian governments, such moves have also provoked concern about how officials could stretch their power. Mr. Bukele won office last year as an anti-corruption outsider and has gained a reputation for intimidating critics and the media. In early February, he had a showdown with lawmakers that further fueled distrust. Frustrated with legislators' delay to approve an international loan, he entered the chamber along with dozens of armed soldiers dressed for battle. Now, El Salvador is in good company as neighboring nations catch up on anti-coronavirus measures. But in a region with recent memory of abuses, some critics eye those actions warily as well. This story was reported by Whitney Ulick in Mexico City for The Monitor.
No final lectures, rushed farewells. No graduation for now. For this college senior, it was jarring, but he's finding new lessons to be learned.
Snow was on the ground and graduation something to look forward to in May. To Josh Ebelman and his classmates at Cornell University in upstate New York, news of a coronavirus emerging in China this past winter seemed very far away. Suddenly, today the dorms are closed and students are scattered across the globe. An important and formative stage in my life had come to a sudden halt, writes Josh. Some students heeded calls to socially distance almost immediately, but many, especially certain seniors, partied as hard as ever. Perhaps they refused to accept this new reality. Perhaps they grasped it faster than most and decided to put up one last fight against it. As with many organizations and governments, the varying pace and degree of high-level decisions is resulting in lots of uncertainty for everyone else. But then I reflect on the inspiring stories of a healthcare worker's putting themselves in harm's way, Josh writes, dealing with medical supply shortages and unimaginable pressure. And I realize that there are heroes instilling in all of us a lesson in courage and kindness we would otherwise not get to learn in the lecture hall. The story was reported by Josh Ebelman in Lexington, Massachusetts for The Monitor.
Are you sharing more screen time with family these days? Film critic Peter Rayner offers his latest list of comfort flicks, reminding us in the process that movies meant for kids can also charm the young at heart. Check out today's Daily for his recommendations. Now, commentary on armed conflicts from the Monitor's editorial board. In a plea last Monday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres asked armed groups around the world to call an immediate ceasefire in their hot conflicts. "The fury of the virus illustrates the folly of war," he said. Indeed, the urgency of the COVID-19 pandemic does put a clarifying perspective on all human differences. By Thursday, rebel forces in at least four countries, the Philippines, Syria, Yemen, and Libya, had heeded the call. The coronavirus has reached most conflict zones in the world's poorest countries, putting everyone on a level playing field. In effect, these militia groups decided to trade handguns for hand wipes and don humanitarian hats for military helmets. Some also welcomed outside medical aid for both themselves and the non-combatants around them. At a deeper level, the change of heart reflects what Mr. Guterres calls a clear conscience emerging. By continuing to fight, armed groups are aiding the spread of the virus. The health emergency compels a lockdown on war, he said, so that everyone can focus together on the true fight of our lives. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. And thanks for joining us today. Tomorrow, we'll look at virtual places of worship. From drive-through confessionals to the strange intimacy of Zoom, congregations are adapting, even if it's difficult at times. When life storms roar, sometimes it can seem the only certainty is uncertainty. But turning to God, the unchangingly loving principle of the universe, opens the door to progress and healing. You can find our Christian Science Spiritual Perspective column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jingnan Peng and Jeff Turton.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor, copyright 2020.